You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If you think conspiracy theories are a relatively new phenomenon, well, think again. In his latest book, The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right, Arthur Goldwag reveals a long record of something some have called political paranoia in America, going all the way back to the Revolution. His book is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Goldwag to our show today. Hello.
Hello. I'm very glad to be here.
Last week, the New York Times reported that Tea Party groups have been protesting Agenda 21, a non-binding international resolution that encourages nations of the world to conserve open space and natural resources. It seems benign enough, but the Tea Party is calling it a UN-led conspiracy to deny property rights.
Well, a couple weeks ago, I drove up to Westport, Connecticut, and I sat in at a John Birch Society meeting.
The John Birch Society still survives?
The John Birch Society survives, and it's been doing pretty well. And the New England coordinator ran the meeting, and the topic was Agenda 21. And they have been flogging this all over the country because it's a winning issue for them. And it's very strange to sit there from the outside and listen to this because, of course, it's a 20-year-old issue that has just come blazing back to life.
Well, the some of the main supporters of the Tea Party, the Koch brothers, their father was one of the founders of the John Birch Society. So are there links between the two? Because I think that most Tea Party people would tell you they have nothing to do with the John Birch Society.
Well, I don't know if there's formal links, and there's a whole bunch of different tea parties. There's a whole bunch of different organizations. Some of them are for profit. You know, the Judson Phillips one is for profit. There's a lot of sympathy. The candidates that the speaker at the meeting I went to, he talked about Michelle Bachmann was still in the race then, and he talked about Ron Paul, of course. And a lot of the people that were there, I think, were Ron Paul people.
Well, the John Birch Society was mostly about a communist conspiracy. Do they still see a communist conspiracy in the United States?
That's what Agenda 21 is. It's a conspiracy to destroy sovereignty, to take your guns away, to take you off the land. There's a whole trend going on. Urbanists talk very excitedly about densification, and they talk about forcing people out of their houses and making them live in apartments.
The Tea Party members have been showing up at planning meetings to denounce proposed bike lanes as a limit to personal liberty. They also complained in Virginia about a board of supervisors that pays dues to a nonprofit that consults on environmental sustainability. But can we call these things the new hate, or is this just the kind of weird twist in American politics?
Well, first of all, when you read my book, you'll see, as I say over and over again, the new hate isn't all that new. But the new hate, what I call the new hate, which is a reflection of the old hate. It's a story. It's a narrative. And it's a story.
So there's a thread that runs through it going all the way back to the Illuminati fears of the 1790s?
There's an absolute thread, but it's not a continuous thread. It's that each group of people tells the same story with a different protagonist and a different
antagonist.
And
what's that story? That there's an outside group that's trying to take over?
That there is an inside group that's trying to take over. And they may be your neighbors. They may be leaders of your community. They may be the president of the United States. But there is a group that wants to take away what you have.
Well, is this uniquely American? Weren't similar things being said in Europe in the religious wars and in all of the attacks on the Freemasons? And then, of course, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which claimed that the Jews were trying to take over the world?
Well, what's interesting is that things like this were happening in Europe at a time when they weren't happening here. The Illuminati scare, when it exploded in the 1790s, the Illuminati were a group of secularists that wanted to undermine royalty, and they wanted to take out the established church. It's very strange that it had such resonances here, because we were a country that had just overthrown our monarchical overlords, and we had, you know, ratified a constitution that didn't have an established church. But there you have it. There was a Masonic scare in the 1920s, which was really just a continuation of the Illuminati scare. It was fear of secularism, fear of finance. The rural Americans have always had, when you look at the history of rural America, very unstable. The bottom was dropping out all the time. So when somebody could come to you and tell you a story that has there's bankers, the national bank, but there's been fear of national banks in America since the beginning. There's been fear of secularism in America since the beginning. There's been this, here we are a secular country, and there's this tension.
And why is secularism such a continual affair, fear?
Well, if you believe if you believe that we're living on the brink of end times, and if you believe that the only way of salvation is through your church, secularism is very frightening. It's not really secularism, it's Satanism.
But those people are going to go to hell. What's the difference?
Well, in the meantime, we're here, and depending upon what kind of millennialism you subscribe to, you may believe that we need to make a Christian nation before Jesus will come back.
One of the most fascinating political parties ever, at least name-wise, was the Know-Nothing Party. Part of the same thing?
That was a little different, but it had resonances. The Know-Nothings were... they arose out of it kind of comes out of the end of the anti-masonry period. You get the Know-Nothing period. The population of the country changed so dramatically. There was this tremendous influx of Irish, and it changed the cities beyond recognition for a lot of people. And the original Know-Nothings were there were a whole bunch of Know-Nothing groups. They were set up, a lot of them, in emulation of the Masons. They were secret societies with handshakes and, you know, and all kinds of things. But they were trying to preserve the America that they knew.
So they wanted to keep immigrants out. This is another theme, of course, that has been continual throughout our history, despite the fact that at that time America was really growing as a result of all this influx of immigrants.
Absolutely.
And Statue of Liberty said, send us out, you're tired, you're poor. But there were people saying, no, keep them out. Then we wind up with the Ku Klux Klan, which has a similar message, doesn't it? It's not just anti-African-American. It also is anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish.
And prohibitionist. That's another side of the Klan too. It was the Catholics were associated with and cities were associated with drinking.
Now, you include McCarthyism in this. The McCarthyism and John Birch Society linked together. Communists under every bed.
They were linked together. McCarthy was probably the John Birch Society is so extreme, in that it's a product of Robert Welch's mind, you know, and his mind. He was a brilliant, brilliant guy. He was a math prodigy. He graduated from college when he was like 14 or 15 years old. I find him very interesting. He was not an anti-Semite, although most of the energy in the John Birch Society in the early days was anti-Semitic. Some of the a lot of the white nationalist groups broke off from him.
Robert Welch once said, "Some of my best friends are anti-Semites." Just a joke, but he suggested that Dwight Eisenhower was involved in a communist conspiracy.
Absolutely.
So what happens when the communists don't take over as a result of Eisenhower's presidency?
Well, this is another funny thing.
Well, that the Catholics don't take over, or the Pope doesn't wind up being consulted when Kennedy becomes president.
I talk about conspiracy theory a lot, and one of the hallmarks of conspiracy theory is this incredible urgency. It's about to happen. It's about, well, you know, last year there was, I'm forgetting his name now, but there was that radio and TV preacher who said the world was going to end, and he had said he had done this 10 years ago, and then he did it again a couple months later. Now, going all the way back to the 1830s, America had Millerism, and this guy Robert Miller predicted to the day. And people sold their land, and it didn't happen. This is called the Great Disappointment. We've been doing this in America. We've been predicting the end. It doesn't happen. And then we move on and predict the end again.
My guest is Arthur Goldwag. His latest book, The New Hate, a History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right. Why use fear and loathing, Hunter Thompson's famous phrase, in your subtitle?
It was funny that the story of that subtitle is funny. It was a working subtitle. I just threw it on the book. I assumed the publisher was going to change it. And the typography on the cover even looks like the Ralph Steadman typography. I used it because I think that what drives conspiracy theory is fear and hatred. And I used it because I think that's precisely my topic.
Now, does the hate always come from the right? Weren't there lots of conspiracy theories from the left following the Kennedy assassination and the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Bobby Kennedy?
The hate can absolutely come from the left. I'm writing about a phenomenon that has historically been on the right. The variety of hatred that I'm writing about is more characteristic of the right than the left. I'm not writing about mean-spiritedness and anger either. And if anyone wants to challenge me by saying that the communists have a conspiracy theory, I would be the first to agree with them. But the communist conspiracy theory isn't as personalized. It comes out of an economic ideology. The bourgeoisie are bad people because they don't fit into the economic future.
Well, a lot of people claim there are conspiracies. Vladimir Putin claims that the protests in Russia are being funded by America. So Assad is claiming the same thing in Syria. The Americans are paying for it. And now we have Egypt arresting Americans because of some odd conspiracy the Egyptian military has come up with.
It goes part and parcel with absolutism, which is part of the reason that I deplore it, because it's a phenomena that I'd rather see just associated with dictators than with American politicians.
But you're saying there's a strain of absolutism in this country.
It's a strain. It's on the fringes. It's never been a majority strain. But there are people that will tell you it really is the Jews. It really is. And then they have a theory of everything.
Well, you have on your cover, you also have a bit of a picture of Barack Obama, and there are people who say that the current fear and loathing is because Barack Obama is black. Hasn't racism been a thread throughout much of the populist rights history?
It has, and I think that the inauguration of a black president was a tectonic moment for a lot of people on the right. At the same time, I mean, I haven't written a partisan book that says don't criticize Barack Obama or you're a racist. There are any number of reasons to criticize Obama, but a lot of the vehemence, a lot of the anger, a lot of it is because of this horror that basically the worst thing that you can imagine happening has happened. Henry Ford wrote about, you know, my God, what if we had a Disraeli in this country? we already have Jews in the cabinet, but what if we had a Jewish president?
He used to hand out copies of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
It was a revelation for him when he read it. It explained everything in the world.
Arthur Goldwag's latest book is The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right. It's published by Pantheon. He's also written Cults, Conspiracy Theories and Secret Societies, and Isms and Ologies. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Arthur Goldwag, G-O-L-D-W-A-G. His new book, The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right, is published by Pantheon. Why do you call Ann Coulter and Glenn Beck performance artists? Aren't they serious political forces in this country, along with Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, and some of the other talk radio superstars?
I hope that they're not serious influences.
They have big audiences.
They have enormous audiences. I suspect that they are they're very important in that they reflect people's feelings rather than that they shape them. When Father Coughlin tried to go into active politics, he discovered that he had no power to bring votes. I suspect that, Ann Coulter...
Well, Rush Limbaugh is credited with turning Congress around one election cycle.
He was. And they all paid court to him, and he... We'll see what he does this fall.
Do you think someone like Glenn Beck or Ann Coulter, whom these two make pretty outrageous remarks sometimes... do you think they actually believe what they're saying, or are they playing to an audience?
It's speculation. I suspect that Glenn Beck is more sincere than she is, because I think he may be a little crazier than she is.
But she says something like, let's invade all of the Middle Eastern countries and Christianize everybody.
She said that right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And was it the National Review fired her because of that?
She still writes bestsellers.
Yeah. Probably not as bestseller as they were when she was fresher, but sure. I think that there is I won't give them credit to say that there's that much seriousness in them. I will say that my saying that they're not serious will infuriate the people who like them.
You say that The New Hate hides in plain sight. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'll give an example of, Glenn Beck did this big documentary on George Soros, and what he was saying essentially was he was putting a new villain into the template of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
But he was saying that George Soros had benefited from the Holocaust, even though he was a victim of the Holocaust.
He was a little kid who was a young man or a teenager or whatever he was. He in his own telling, he was involved in some betrayals. And the story of the Holocaust, God knows, is a story of tons and tons and tons of Jewish collaboration. Pretty much every survivor probably had something to feel guilty about, as Primo Levi wrote about at great length. One of the awful things that people do on both sides of the political divide is use the Holocaust as a wedge, and it's a pretty vile thing. But what Glenn Beck was doing was he was saying, here's a foreign Jew who claims to be a progressive, but he's actually, he's both on the side of the billionaires and big finance and on the side of the communists. And this is exactly what Henry Ford was saying about the financial powers of his day.
Perhaps the biggest issue in American politics today is the growing economic divide and the shrinking of the middle class. How does increasing class consciousness play into what you're writing about?
I think it's huge. And again, it's an issue that when you talk about it, you're going to infuriate people, because people are going to hear you and you're going to say, oh, you're saying because I'm lower class that I'm not as smart as you, or so on. But we have the American class mobility has always been less than it's been made out to be, but it has existed.
Someone like Steve Jobs can start.
He didn't go to college.
Yeah.
And there were, especially after World War II, there were unionized manufacturing workers that made a really good living and were able to transport their children into a different way of life. And we're living at a time now where this is sort of teetering.
But in the past, when the poor were threatened, they tended to move to the left. That we saw that during the Depression, when the Communist Party's numbers swelled. We're seeing an awful lot of people who are not wealthy joining the Tea Party and supporting policies that, at least in theory, benefit the rich.
This is Tom Frank's subject, and it's fascinating because now I talk about this part of it. Richard Hofstadter, who influences my thinking enormously in The Paranoid Style in American Politics, he talks about historians that are completely positivistic, that assume that everything is economic, are missing something. Values play a huge role, and there are people who feel that their values are being offended, and they genuinely do. And a lot of the people that hate abortion genuinely hate abortion.
Well, in a recent interview with Salon.com, you said that people who were both economically disadvantaged and uneducated were more prone to angry thinking. You said one of the most infuriating things about Obama is that he walks into the White House like he belongs there, but he does belong there. After all, he was elected. But their anger is about their place in the world. Their kids will never go there because they're poor and they feel that they're open without avenues.
People, I think an awful lot of people are feeling like the way forward is not clear anymore. An awful lot of people, you know, the story for so many people is, you know, if I could get a manufacturing job, you know, it would pay me $18 an hour. It wouldn't pay me $54 an hour plus benefits plus a pension. It's bizarre, I think. I mean, it truly is bizarre that people don't recognize the incredible role that the unions played in this. You know, they want to destroy the unions, but people, a lot of my subject is irrationality.
But the unions are being blamed for the loss of jobs to other countries like China. And also for the deficits we see in state budgets all over the country.
It's a complex issue.
Haven't the unions done – the unions had to make major concessions to get Detroit back on its feet. So the unions bear some responsibility here?
Of course they do, and globalism bears responsibility. But capital is not on the side of the American working class. Capital is on the side of capital. And capital is moving the jobs out to other countries because that's the logic of capitalism. I mean, I don't want to get into that whole area, but there's where conspiracy thinking comes into play. We're describing something very complex and multilayered, and a Glenn Beck can come along and say, you know what this is about? This is about Acorn. It's about George Soros. Let me draw the lines for you. It all started with Woodrow Wilson and progressivism. They want to take your money away.
Now, people can be accused of certain things at one point, and then it loses its power later. For example, Bill Clinton was called the hippie draft dodger. Then it turns out that there are a lot of politicians who avoided the draft during the Vietnam War in both parties. Recently, Mitt Romney said that his sons didn't serve in the military, but they're being patriotic because they're supporting his political campaign. And nobody made a stink about it. There was a time when womanizing was a big issue. Now Newt Gingrich can just say the press is picking on him. Obama's being called the food stamp president. That's the latest thing. Are they all – do they lose their power after a while?
Well, I think when you have an enemy, you're not necessarily going to throw away your friends. And if your hero for the moment is Newt Gingrich, then you're going to overlook his womanizing.
And Newt Gingrich calls Mitt Romney Obama light and little food stamp. Does that justify his hate in your mind?
It's incredibly mean-spirited, and Gingrich is an incredibly mean-spirited politician. He's always been. I don't really see Gingrich as like a big conspiracy thinker. I don't see him as an ideologue. I think he's too into himself.
But Ron Paul has been involved with conspiracies, and he's a conspiracy thinking, and he's a favorite of white supremacist groups. So why is he so appealing to young liberal types and not just economic libertarians?
I consider Ron Paul such a vexing figure, and in a way, a lot of the ambivalences that are attached to Barry Goldwater are attached to Ron Paul too. I mean, Barry Goldwater was a lifelong member of the NAACP, and he came out for gay rights. And Ron Paul says a lot of things that appeal to me. I think he's a zealot about money. I think he's an ideologue. I suspect that at bottom he doesn't have that big a moral issue with the white supremacists that he's been involved with. But a lot of what he says is absolutely wonderful. And I give him that. And what I've been saying publicly lately is I think maybe the fact that he has been outed as a racist in the past has made it harder for him to use racist dog whistles. So he avoids it now.
Do you think that the rhetoric has become more personal now? Is that an aspect of the hate talk? And do you have the situation where the internet can really blow a story up to some major proportions, where in the past it might not have gotten as much attention?
Anyone that reads American history knows that the partisan newspapers of days past were incredibly nasty. Anyone that reads fringe publications knows that the ugliness of a figure like Revelo P. Oliver, who I write about, incredible racist in the 50s and 60s. The internet makes it so much more accessible than it used to be. Television makes some of these things so much more accessible. But the most damaging rhetoric to me, I mean, food stamp president, is that's code. You can look right into the camera and say, but more people are on food stamps than they used to be. That's not racist signaling, but it is racist signaling, and I think it's quite ugly.
Even though food stamps were created under a Republican administration,
and food stamps, we know that the vast majority of people that receive food stamps are white. I mean, it's just what it is.
So the new hate is, are you suggesting, does play on the prejudices, the old prejudices, race, religion? Is this going to cause Mitt Romney a problem somewhere down the line?
I was very struck by when Mitt Romney was giving his acceptance speech in Florida. I was struck by the nastiness of it. that's not what he or his handlers are going to want from him. They're going to want him to be very presidential and centrist.
I'm talking about attacks on him as a Mormon.
The attacks on him as a Mormon, that's going to be an ugly thing. And the Mormons have skeletons in their closets.
As says Mitt Romney, who points out his father was an immigrant. He was born in Mexico. He was born in Mexico because his grandfather had gone there to set up a polygamous community.
This is true.
It's a complicated situation, but as you point out, nobody is totally blameless throughout his life, and so you could pretty much do this to everybody. But you're suggesting that there's been this right-wing populist strain that has been more virulent in this country?
I think so. I mean, I'm a person of the left, and I had no intention to write a perfectly balanced book. But I think that the real fight, the big picture, is that there are forces of secularism and the Enlightenment thinking, and there are forces that push in the opposite direction. And the great conspiracist narrative. I mean, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, this is written for the benefit of the Tsar, to urge him not basically. Probably the people who forged it were doing it for the Tsar directly, to urge him not to make reforms. I find it so strange that American Protestants gathered around this Russian Orthodox royalist document. But this is my fear is that when you foment hatred, when you're doing it to fight secularism, to fight progressivism.
Arthur Goldwag's new book, The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right, is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.